Ja, ich habe das große Vergnügen, im Namen der Jury Ihnen Hamed Aboud und seine Übersetzerin Larissa vorzustellen, mit Larissa Bender vorzustellen, mit einem wirklich in jeder Hinsicht ungewöhnlichen Buch. Das Buch ist insofern ungewöhnlich, als es einen Verlagsnamen hat, der in der Geschichte der Verlage und der Verlagsnamen eine ganz besondere Stelle einnimmt. Der Verlag heißt Pudel und Pinscher. Und er heißt wirklich so. Die zweite Ungewöhnlichkeit ist, er ist in der Schweiz, was ich auch nicht wusste und habe mich auch erst kundig machen müssen. Die dritte wunderbare Ungewöhnlichkeit dieses Buches ist, Sie können es von vorne wie von hinten lesen. Wenn Sie es von hinten lesen, müssen Sie nur eine kleine Bedingung erfüllen, nämlich Arabisch können. Es ist in zwei Sprachen gedruckt. Es war sehr schön gedruckt.
You have to do it in Arabic. It's beautifully printed.
Menschen das Buch anschauen können.
So anyone who speaks Arabic will be able to read this book that way round.
Erfindung des Verlages ist, sondern
now this wasn't just a pretty idea that the publisher had. Unfortunately, it's also a political measure,
kann man sich vorstellen,
a political ruse, if you like. If you know that Hamed Aboud is from Syria and is living in exile in Austria. Anyway, welcome to you.
Die dritte Ungewöhnlichkeit dieses, oder vierte,
the fourth unusual fact about this book
is that,
obviously, as we've heard, it was written in Arabic, but we have an author before us who is so incredibly gifted in languages that after 2 years living in exile in Austria, he's so good at German that we've decided not to have him interpreted from Arabic to German. I don't know where he gets this genius from, being able to learn a language that quickly in 2 years. I don't know. I don't have this talent. So it's a small, magnificent book, and it consists of stories which could perhaps be described as calendar stories. You're perhaps not familiar with this concept. We had this in the 18th century when people started to print calendars that people could put into their pockets, and a lot of authors like to have quotes of theirs printed in these calendars. So they were these little pocket calendars which contained stories or quotes. They were very unusual. They weren't linear narratives of the kind you've just heard. They're very complex and often surprising. They work with little surprises to prevent a lack of ambiguity. So my first question to the author is this a form, these stories that are printed here, is that something that people do back in your country, or is it something you invented? Well, first of all, thank you very much for the kind introduction. I have to say that, to be honest, I don't know. I suppose it's a normal mixture of poetry, narrative, imagination. It's reality, but it's also fiction. And I suddenly started to write this way. And then I discovered, step by step, with Larissa.
Sind Sie denn auf Larissa gekommen?
Well, how did you find Larissa? That's the question. Larissa is the most famous translator in the Arab region, especially in among Syrian authors. We all know Larissa. She's the only one who has fantastic experience. And I had to do my book with this unique person. Of course, none of that is true, says Larissa. Well, of course, you would normally turn to the best person in the telephone directory. So, okay, in Syria, what I wanted to ask, is there a tradition of this strange form? Because it's not just short stories, they're not narratives in a classical sense. We have to say that Hamid began with poetry. He started by writing poetry, so he was a lot closer to
Prosa Gedichten dran ist als als an der richtigen Erzählung, ja?
Prosa in poetic form than narrative in the classic sense. Let me say, I studied telecommunications. I come out of IT. My father's a maths teacher. So numbers play a big part in my life. And show me how compact the text has to be. Also, I've read a great deal of philosophy when I wrote the first book. So there are lots of factors at play here. But on the form, I have to say that because of the revolution, there was we have a new generation. It's the generation of the revolution. They experimented, they tried things out, they developed new formats. This mix, everyone's doing their own new form. And probably because I fled, I went first to Egypt and then Istanbul and along the Balkan route. And I found my form, bearing in mind my background, my training, my studies, and my own experience. Now, I'm very naive, perhaps, asking this question. I don't know anything at all about Arab literature. Of course, I know a bit about Arab poetry. Anyone who's older than 200 years in Germany will know Goethe. There's Adonis, of course, and we know that there are storytellers with a strong oral tradition, like Arafik Shami. That is prose that is an attempt to take an oral tradition and convert it into written literature. But tell us a little, if you will. How in Syria, in the current situation, you become a poet? Don't you have other worries in this terrible time? You mean people can't write because it's a terrible time? For a writer, it's the only thing you can do. And in this point, this is how the function of writing changes. Before the revolution, writing was a luxury. You might write a love poem, for example. But then the function changes. It becomes a mission, a duty, a tool. Because of the situation, I hope that a writer doesn't stop using his or her talent and can use it, make use of it. I don't know, but probably at the moment, for example, for you as an emigre, you can't publish in Syria, can you? No, at the moment, no, not in this way. When I talk about a dictator, I can't, no. Might be other opportunities, but this is a statement, so I can't publish it. And today, if you write in Syria, in the country itself, must one be an advocate, a partisan of Assad?
Between 2011
and 2012, many poets, many writers were put in prison simply because they were writing.
Weil sie unterstützen Assad nicht.
Because they didn't support Assad.
Opposition sind.
And because they wrote from an oppositional standpoint.
Man kann nicht,
no question of that.
Von die andere Seite schreiben unter solche,
you can't write on the other side under a government like that.
Das Furchtbare an der syrischen,
the terrible thing about the Syrian situation for me is that
die Ergebnisse sehen.
We only ever see the outcome. We see a city that's been destroyed. We see the refugee camps in Turkey. We see you here. But life, how can we imagine life under Father Assad? Because he wasn't a saint who gave birth to an evil son. There was a long tradition of repression in the country and the Secret Service and so forth. So people know about that, but is there a modern literature that predates the revolution? In a small group, yes. It wasn't well known. I don't think... There was a small circle that was trying to renew literature. And if we're talking about repression and so forth, there was a small circle of authors who tried to write about the government and to transpose that into a different kind of language. But they always ended up in prison, always. And we know the story again and again that an author spent 17, 20 years in prison. And then went away and his book was published. But we had this rupture that came with the revolution, which led to a lot of Syrian writers coming to Germany, a lot of experiments, a lot of new literature, and also this book is in a way an archive. It chronicles life before the war, throughout the war, that of refugees. There is a time before the war, which it also describes. But you can imagine, if one has, like me, a very vague understanding of book culture in Arabic countries, in Egypt, there are publishing houses. Yes, millions of books, millions of publishers. Millions. And they don't want to print this book? They haven't. Well, of course, I'm interested in that. Because these stories are written for us. Now all the Arab countries, Syria, Iraq, Jordan, Lebanon, Egypt, Libya, all these countries have publishers, but they're also fighting or carrying out a revolution or fighting a war. So there is a book market, yes, but we also have a lot of authors and a lot of poets. And what do they write about? They also write wonderful love poetry, don't they? Well, it depends on the situation. There are authors who carry on writing in their old way and haven't changed at all. And there are others who've experienced this break. Larissa knows this too, because like I said, she has a great deal of experience. She knows lots of different authors. She knows the politicians, the politics. She knows the fiction. So let's ask Larissa. When is there going to be a big anthology of modern Arab poetry or poème et prose? Is anyone working on it? I'm not, says Larissa, but probably other people who tend to translate poetry, which isn't what I normally do. We discuss this. Here it's not clear, is this poetry or texts? I am indeed working on a volume of prose poets by one author. Yes, another Syrian author, and after that I'll be doing a novel, also a Syrian author. But I wanted to say something briefly about that, because, of course, before the revolution, there was a very active literary movement in Syria. Most authors did their publishing in Beirut, though, or occasionally in Egypt. There was censorship, but you could still live. And then, depending on how the regime felt, you would occasionally be interviewed by the security service or maybe occasionally arrested. But now more people, more writers live abroad. And there's an explosion of authors, Syrians. He didn't study Arabic. He said he studied IT. And there are lots of engineers, mathematicians, and they're all writing. And I think that this writing is a way of responding to the situation, to the war. You can see it from the text that he's written. So I don't think that there's going to be an anthology. Of course, there's one anthology after another. There's one coming out now. But I think the authors that have come here as émigrés, first of all, they have to get themselves sorted out, and then they'll look and see whether they have any opportunity to survive in the market, because there are so many of them. I think almost every week I get an inquiry, maybe every 2 weeks, but almost every week I get inquiries from Syrians who say, I'm writing a novel, I've written some poetry, can you translate it? And of course, I don't have a complete overview of the book. I know in the past, publishers haven't been particularly interested in Arabic literature. We'll have to see what happens now. There won't be one anthology, but as I said, I think now there's more interest both in Arab poetry and in Arab prose. And in the next few years, we'll be reading more about it. Has language changed then? Language. We live with this naive idea that the Arab language hasn't really changed over centuries or only in little nuances. And there's this fantastic good fortune that across the Levant and from Maghreb right across to the east, everyone understands Arabic. It's almost like speaking English. And we, with our German readership, don't have such a good hand. But are the differences between the Arab languages big or small? Received language, if you like, is the same everywhere, but you need to know the country. You can't simply ad lib, ad hoc, translate a novel from a Moroccan author, for example. I don't know Morocco, I don't know society, I don't know the details, I don't know how people live. In Syria, I do know, and that's why obviously it's much easier for me to translate things. And the language has changed, not a lot, because the big changes are happening in day-to-day language. Colloquial language is very, very different between the different countries. Let's say a Moroccan who is not very well read would find it difficult to talk to a Syrian who hadn't spent long at school. They're very different. But the received language is the same. Dialects are very different. They're very flexible. They change. And that's what keeps the language vital. But book Arabic is always a bit stiff. And I have to say that the use of colloquial language has also changed in the sense that authors are using colloquial language now. I know from the last 6 years there was a real necessity for culture and received language, colloquial language and received language, to get together, to meet up and start to mix. Because This is fairly new. It's been happening in the last 6 years. So it's a revolution in writing too. And the metaphors, which have one meaning in High Arabic and another meaning in colloquial Arabic, this is quite new, and it's to do with my, even for my generation. I can imagine reading these stories that you can't compare this with the familiar old Arab things we know about. Please say something briefly about why you speak such good German. Well, not good German, a bit of German. I'm very motivated because I wanted to talk to people. That was my motive. And I have a lot of time as a refugee. As a refugee, I can wait 11 months. I had to wait 11 months to hear about my status. So I knew, as a Syrian, that the situation in Syria is very complex and it isn't going to change in the next few years. And I knew I would get my approval. And that's why I was able to focus on learning that little bit of German that I know until I established contact with Austrians, and then I was able to practice what I knew and develop it. And how do you learn Arabic? That's a longer-lasting process, I have to say, because at the university we learn High Arabic, and then you don't understand any dialects, and you can't talk to people, and that's the problem. So for 6 years, or 6 semesters rather, I studied. I went to Syria, and I didn't understand a word. But then I went back to Syria again and again, and I kept trying, and at some point, after decades that I've been doing this, I have some grasp of it. We'd never have guessed looking at you. Now, what interests me, these texts, and I hope you have an opportunity to read a little more than the two texts we heard. You have to buy these books, not just to make the author rich, but so that we have some idea of the way he writes and the way he thinks. Because it's not just a matter of short texts with a bit of surrealism, maybe. A surrealism that is obviously closely linked to reality. I don't know whether you just heard this death story. It would be a very different story to read about in other contexts. So this is a political question. Do you think that in your lifetime you'll ever live in Damascus again? I can only hope. Reality tells me something different. But in my heart, I only have the hope that I will manage this. But Assad's life is surely limited. You don't believe that this is a conflict that will be resolved in our own times. Politics is very complicated these days in our situation. I've written about it. I didn't know anymore who has power to change this situation. Who's fighting whom? Who's interested in what? Who controls the country at the moment? We have kind of lost sight of it. Of course, we have our own reality. That's simple, a revolution against a government for freedom. That's a Syrian reality. That's a Syrian truth. And that's something I wanted to do with the book, talk about my truth. But the way the world sees the country is completely different. Would you agree? Are you also pessimistic? I think I'm not quite so pessimistic for him, because he's 30 years younger than me. I think for me, I'm pessimistic about myself. I went to Syria for the first time in 2010, and I really don't believe that I can go back there because the situation is so confused. And for a long time, the Syrians haven't had the power to change it themselves. Who are the Syrians? Of course, that's the next question, because Syrians are fighting Syrians. But really, it's international politics. It's the neighboring countries. And at the moment, the complex situation is people always thought it must get better now, it must get better now, and it's got worse and worse. And now it's 6 years and it's still getting worse. Bearing in mind Qatar and Saudi Arabia now, or what's happening in Turkey, all of this has an impact on the situation in Syria. And it's just getting more and more complicated and further away from any kind of a rational political solution.
I think so as well, without knowing more about the details,
but all my Syrian friends say something similar. And of course that makes me say that Hamed must has to write a great utopian novel. He has to declare himself a dictator and say, tell us how to restructure the entire Near and Middle East, step by step. The little book was my first step. It was a kind of trying to establish a point de repère. Where have I got to as a refugee? But it all takes time. That's why authors, men, women, myself, have to write about the past. It's absolutely essential. Because after fleeing the country, little children, for example, or people who had these experiences, forget the past. That's my perspective as an IT author. It's a duty. Literature must remind people the way it used to be and what should happen next. In 1992, there was that great massacre in Hama, and nobody ever spoke or wrote about it. And only now, with the revolution and the liberation, quite apart from the war scenario in Syria, there's been a liberation of people's minds, and above all, writers who are abroad are starting to address the Hama massacre and to process it in literature. And that's something that's really important for people too, because otherwise it's forgotten. And only the families who were hit, they have their traumas, which they pass on from one generation to the next, but no one's ever written about it. And this is a great opportunity. So, as I said, quite apart from the disastrous situation, there's an opportunity for the country here to look at the events not only of the last 5 years, but of the last 30 years in literature. And that's quite a special moment. That's very similar to the Soviet Union and to the GDR. Everyone said 3 years after the wall fell, where are the big GDR novels? It takes time. And writers who respond immediately and write their big novels aren't necessarily the best ones. You have to let these things take their time. So we have to make sure that writers living here in exile get the resources, the money they need to take that time so that they can write something. And this, I did think about whether to wait and then write about my experience as a refugee. And what about the way I see Austrian society? Should I wait 10 years, 20 years, and then write a novel? But I wanted to do something fresh. I wanted to nail my disillusionment, my hope. And if I found any hope, I immediately wanted to nail it down, describe it. So to me, that's a difficult question. The people who survive in Syria, should they write now or should they wait? Well, they shouldn't wait, but there are, of course, different ways that you can approach it. And everyone is grateful for authentic testimonies in the newspapers about the situation in Syria, about concrete situations that people are in. But that's got nothing to do with art. A great novel takes longer anyway. But the feelings in art. Yes, but that's why at the beginning I was so anxious to ask whether this was a form that existed in the past in Arab literature and which you have adopted, or is it a form which the world has imposed upon you? I think it's developed by itself, it's evolved by itself. 80% of the book I wrote without paper while I was on the road. I wrote on my mobile phone. When I heard that there was material, I immediately said to Larissa, I'm bringing my head with me. I've got my head and my smartphone. I think that's my experience, and that's influenced the way I work. We often talk about this, about whether this is a poetic language or a narrative or a mix. It's a mix, and it's because of the 6 years. Are you planning a second book now? Well, I hope.
Here, yeah.
In your head? Yes, yes, in my head. The last part. What happened to the migrating birds? That was my experience in Austria. I wrote about that. And now I want to carry on writing about my past, about my history, but also about my experience in Austria as a refugee. May I write about Austrian society or mustn't I? Questions like that. May I write about what I've seen, felt, heard? Or should I only focus on my history? That's the next question that I'm working towards. And the next project is Austrians play a part in these texts. They're not just viewers. Are you using the male form there or the female form? I'm being politically correct and using both. They play a role in the text. They're not just observers. They are part of the substance. And I hope that I will set something up. Okay, well, we're only the readers. Unfortunately, we're not experts. And the entire jury was extremely delighted with your book and your translation. And with Larissa Bender, we don't need to worry. She will continue to deliver the goods for us and the news. But for you, we can only wish you every success. And I hope that soon we have another book from you in the jury. Thank you very much.
Noch ein kleiner Test.
A little test.
Es kommt immer die Okra-Schote vor.
You talk about ladies' fingers, okra, again and again.
Die Frage ist, können Sie
the question
den Geschmack
is,
beschreiben?
Can you describe the taste?
Es ist nicht von nur vor dem Geschmack.
It's not just about taste.
Erlebnisse selber.
It's about the experience
diese
itself.
Okra von mein Mutter,
this okra. My mother's here today. Thank God. And these are experiences one must have for oneself.